how he ate things and how he went to the toilet and how he addressed people, how he did business. Everything about his life became theologically very important, and that was all sifted and thought through, and it was written up into a very extensive code of laws known as the Sharia, which literally means the way or the road. And it's called the way or the road because Islam offers guidance, a path to walk upon. So the Sharia is the path that you walk on if you're following the guidance of Muhammad, his example, and the word that Allah gave to him in the Quran. So the Sharia is a set of rules and principles, including theology, but also criminal justice, for every aspect of life. Clothing, business, warfare, politics, good manners, sexual relations, family life, marriage, death, everything, or just about everything, is covered there in one way or another. All based on the example and the teaching of Muhammad. Now, one thing that's very important about the Sharia is that it's constructed by the great Islamic scholars assuming on the assumption of an Islamic society. That is, the Sharia applies in a society which is led and ruled by Muslims, for Muslims. In fact, in classical Islamic law, it was forbidden for a non-Muslim to live outside of the Dar al-Islam, the place that was under Islam, for more than 4 days at a time. A merchant couldn't leave the house of Islam for more than 4 days. The world has changed a lot since that period. But the whole concept of Sharia presupposed an Islamic state. In fact, there are some Muslims today that say that there'll never be true religious freedom for Muslims until justice is determined by Islamic principles. That a Muslim is never truly free in their religion until Sharia law rules in the land. Now, these rules also included an extensive set of principles which determined the place of non-Muslims living under Islam. That's why I'm particularly interested, because that's me. And this is what I'm going to be speaking about tonight, those that made that third choice. The conditions of non-Muslims living under Islamic rule is determined by some key theological principles from the Quran, and I'll mention a few of these principles. One is that the Quran says that Muslims, as the successful ones, remember, Islam offers success, are the best people in creation with a destiny to guide all mankind. I've heard this verse quoted often by Muslims here in Melbourne and all around the world. It says, "You are the best community that's been raised up for mankind. You command right conduct and forbid indecency." So Muslims have a mandate from Allah to instruct on what's right and wrong. And the second theological principle is it's the destiny of Islam to rule over all other religions. So this is also from the Quran. "He it is who has sent his messenger," that's Muhammad, "with the guidance and the religion of truth, that he may cause it to triumph over all religion." Well, this is part of the success that Islam promises, dominance in this life, political dominance. These are not controversial things I'm speaking about Islam. These are mainstream ideas. Also, as regards Christians and Jews, it's important to understand that Islam teaches that it is the religion, the original religion, that Islam is the original religion. Islam teaches that Moses was a Muslim, David was a Muslim, Solomon, Jesus, John the Baptist, they're all Muslims. And Christians and Jews who are called people of the book, that's a reference to the fact that they were given a book by Moses or by Jesus or David or whatever, but they've now gone astray. Remember, you pray to be on the right path, not of those that have gone astray. There was the Christians in Al-Fatiha. So the Jews and Christians had a book once, because they were once Muslims, but they've lost the book. The book has become corrupted. They don't have it anymore in their hands. And they're now, like, they used to be good Muslims, but they're now not so good Muslims anymore. But they're better off than others who never had the book, I suppose. So Islam understands that it is the original faith, and Christianity and Judaism are kind of false derivatives from it. So it's important to understand that in the worldview of Islam. It's kind of puzzling, really. This is the frame issue. If you're coming from a different frame, it's quite hard to understand the Islamic view that it's the original religion, because we think of it as a later religion. But that's not at all what Muslims are taught to believe. Now, Muhammad was sent by Allah to call all these people, the people of the book and the others, back to their original religion, back to Islam. And the Quran says that true believers will recognize Muhammad and they will follow him. By the way, the implication of what I've just said is that if ever David built, Solomon built a temple in Jerusalem, it was a mosque. It was an Islamic place of worship. Now, there are a few theological. These are a few key theological points that you need to understand, because they set the framework for the position of non-Muslims living under Islamic rule. Back to the three choices. I said before that Islam is based on the Quran, which we've heard about, and the Sunnah, the example and the teaching of Muhammad. Well, Muhammad taught about the three choices. He said, fight in the name of Allah and in the way of Allah, fight against those who disbelieve in Allah, that is, who don't accept Islam. When you meet your enemies, invite them to three courses of action. There's the three choices. He said, invite them to accept Islam. First choice, if they respond to you, accept it from them and desist from fighting against them, so they become Muslims. Then he mentions what I call the third choice. If they refuse to accept Islam, demand from them the tribute. If they agree to pay, accept it from them and hold off your hand, so they pay a compensation to the Muslims instead of converting. And then the second choice comes in now, it's in a different order. If they refuse to pay the tax, seek Allah's help and fight them. The word in Arabic, fight, is based on the word to kill. This is not like a fight in the schoolyard, this is a fight to kill. That's quite important in the Quran, because when words are translated fight, the actual Arabic is a little bit stronger in its force than the English word fight means. Now, the order of these three choices is varied in different sources, but they're always the same three choices: Islam, the sword, or surrender. Occasionally there's no surrender, there's just the Islam and the sword, but the surrender is allowed for the people of the book. So the question of whether Islam was spread by force is one of the great contested issues of this day. I don't mean that you can't answer that question, I believe you can, but it's an issue about which people disagree, and some Muslims will say it wasn't spread by force. And like the Grand Mufti, they'll say, well, look, the dhimma, the surrender that was given to people, there was an option. They allowed people to keep their faith. If the Grand Mufti is correct, and the key plank in the defence against the accusation of spreading your faith by violence is the third option of surrender to Islamic rule, accepting to live under Sharia law, then it's a matter of the greatest interest what this third choice entails, if that is the whole basis of Islam's claim to tolerance. What does it mean to make that third choice? Well, my book is devoted to explaining that. It works, I should say, on earlier work. It derives from earlier work that's been done by Batnior and others, but it goes a lot deeper on a number of issues. There's a lot of fresh information there. Just as an aside, a lot of wonderful things happen in writing the book. Not an easy book to write. But one of the wonderful things is I discovered in Jordan that there's a website with 100 Islamic commentaries on it, in Arabic. Actually, about 90 commentaries. And there's one particular verse, Surah 929, which is the foundation for this whole dhimma system. Every Islamic scholar will refer to this verse. And we were able to look through all those commentaries on that verse. I had an Arabic-speaking friend. So I've worked through almost 100 commentaries on this issue from the earliest centuries of Islam right through the 20th century. I've examined a huge range of views on it. They all agree. It's not a controversial issue. Now, so that was one of the amazing things. And I drew on that information. There's lots of citations from more than 30 commentaries in the book there that's never been published before. A lot of fascinating information, things to make you laugh and cry, really. Now, I believe that this story of the dhimmis, the non-Muslims, as they're called, living under Islamic rule, or a dhimmitude, the condition under which they live, is one of the most pressing political, social, spiritual issues facing the world today. It's one of the great issues of our time. But one of the problems, the challenges, which I explain in the book, and I explain why that problem exists, is that despite the urgency of this question to understand the situation of non-Muslims living under Islamic rule, this subject is steeped in silence and denial. At the heart of the book is an analysis of the Dhimma Pact itself, the Covenant of Surrender, which in Sharia law is regarded as the contract under which the non-Muslims live. And it's a very interesting quirk of history that the basic characteristics of this pact were established by the Sunnah, by Muhammad's example, in the conquest of the Jews in Khaybar, in Arabia. That's why Hezbollah called their rockets, which they were sending into Israel, Khaybar rockets. And why Amrozi, the bomber, the Balinese bomber, shouted out in the courtroom, "Jews, remember Khaybar." Strange thing for an Indonesian to be shouting out in the courtroom, but actually, theologically, it is the root for this whole dhimmi system. It stands for a claim that Islam will dominate over all other religions. So it's entirely understandable that he would shout that out in a courtroom. It's the heart of his desire to see Islamic law rule. Anyway, in Islamic law, the Dhimma Pact treats non-Muslims as people whose lives would have been forfeit if the Muslims hadn't spared their lives in conquest. This goes back to a pre-Muslim idea that if you conquered another tribe or another group and you let them live, they would owe you their head. In fact, as I explain in the book, it was customary to cut off the forelock, the front hair of a captive that you'd allowed to live, to show that this was someone whose head hadn't been cut off. You sort of missed their head and got their hair instead. There are many references to this in the early sources. Conquered non-Muslims were understood to be in the category of people whose lives had been spared by their conquerors. And the annual jizya head tax paid by dhimmis to the Islamic State is described in all those sources that I referred to as redemption paid by the dhimmis in return for their life. Muslim lexicographers defined the word jizya, which refers to this tribute, as the tax that's taken from the free non-Muslim of a Muslim government, whereby they ratify the contract, the dhimma pact, which ensures them protection, as though it were a compensation for their not being slain. At-Faish, a 19th century Algerian commentator, explains this principle as follows in his comments on 9:29 in the Quran. It was said that jizya is a satisfaction for their blood. It is said that it has sufficed to compensate for their not being slain. Its purpose is to substitute for the duties, the word wajib is a compulsory religious observance, of killing and of slavery. It is for the benefit of Muslims. So what he's saying is that Muslims are obligated by the command in the Quran, Surah 9:29, to fight. And remember, the word fight means to kill. But they can be relieved of this responsibility and compensated for not killing and taking the property of these infidels by paying them money, which is a reimbursement, it's a compensation for them. These are very painful and distressing things to talk about, aren't they? It's quite shocking to think that people would even think in these categories. But you really have to see this is what's written in the commentaries. This was in the 19th century in Algeria. William Eaton wrote a book in 1799 called The Survey of the Turkish Empire, an Englishman. And he describes the payment of this tax as follows. He said the very words of the formulary, the ritual that they were required to be part of, given to the Christian subjects on their paying the capitation tax, this head tax, mean that the sum of money received is taken as compensation for their being permitted to wear their heads that year. In researching this book, I have unearthed the powerful symbolism of the annual tax payment ritual, this jizya payment, which dhimmi males were required to undergo all over the Muslim world until modern times. The payment ritual involved a blow on the neck, or two blows on the neck, at the back and side, and in some versions a form of ritual strangulation, a rope around the neck, signifying that the dhimmi is paying for his life, rescuing his head by this tax. Normally when you took captives to be killed, they'd be led along with a rope around their neck. I was able to find around 30 references to this ritual decapitation from Morocco through to Bukhara, from the 9th to the 20th centuries, from Muslim and non-Muslim sources alike, Christian, European, Jewish, Muslim sources. I've been collecting them for a decade. It is quite hard for us to comprehend. This is a way I try and explain it. Imagine if after conquering England, the Normans required the Anglo-Saxons to line up on every village green each year and to redeem their heads as they hand over in person their tribute to the Normans. And as they do so, they're ritually stabbed in the heart to show that they've escaped death through the tax. This began in 1066, and it will continue in England for another 400 years before it reached the extent of time that it applied, for example, to the Jews in Morocco or the Christians in Damascus or in Baghdad. This continued in Afghanistan for the Jews in Afghanistan right up into the 1950s, it's been reported. Why did it stop? Because the Europeans, the great powers, invaded the Muslim world. The dhimma system was designed to reduce the Christian and other groups, Jewish and other groups, until it was designed to reduce those groups. The 18th century Moroccan commentator Ibn Ajiba described the purpose of this pact and this ritual, which in a passage that I've translated and published for the first time in the book, he said this: the dhimmi is commanded to put his soul, good fortune and desires to death. Above all, he should kill the love of life, leadership and honour. The dhimmi is to invert the longings of his soul. He is to load it down more heavily than it can bear until it is completely submissive. Thereafter, nothing will be unbearable for him. He will be indifferent to subjugation or might. Poverty and wealth will be the same to him. Praise and insult will be the same. Preventing and yielding will be the same. Lost and found will be the same. And then when all things are the same, the soul will be submissive and yield willingly what it should give. Al-Alusi, who was a 19th century Iraqi commentator, speaks about this as plundering the soul of the Dhimmi. But we know, he said, that enslaving them is permitted. Whoever may be enslaved can also be subject to jizya, because both slavery and jizya involve plundering the soul. The case of slavery is clear, because we all benefit from slaves. In the case of jizya, this is produced by the infidel from what he earns, and he lives on what he earns, so when he surrenders his earnings to Muslims, which is his reason for being allowed to live, this is ruled to be equivalent to plundering or taking away his soul. In essence, these great commentaries take the view that non-Muslims are regarded in classical Islamic law as people who owe their lives to their Muslim conquerors. They are expected to adopt an attitude of gratitude and humble inferiority. And the commentators are quite explicit again and again on this issue. Many Sharia regulations were designed to impose the inferiority and invulnerability upon non-Muslims. Just very quickly, the witness of dhimmis is not accepted in a Sharia court, which means that if you're involved in any legal dispute with a Muslim, you basically have no capacity of giving any testimony. It makes you very vulnerable if you've been attacked or raped or something's been stolen from your house, or you're accused of committing a capital offence such as offending the Islam. Dhimmis were required to have lower houses. If you ever visit the old Jewish quarters in Spain, you'll find they're quite small houses. They weren't allowed to ride horses. They had no means of self-defence. It's forbidden for a dhimmi to carry a weapon or have any means of self-defence. You'll find that in Iraq today, if Christian churches have guards, which they often need because many of the churches have been attacked, there'll be Muslims that they'll employ to guard, because it's Christians, it would be offensive to Muslims for Christians to have weapons. There's not allowed to be any visible display of their religion. If you look at photographs taken of Jerusalem in the 19th century, late 19th century, you'll see there are no crosses on tops of any of the churches. No criticism of Islam is permitted. I'd be breaking the pacts tonight. Dhimmis have to dress differently and more poorly. The yellow-coloured patches for Jews was invented under medieval Islam. And even the practice of having public baths continued for several centuries after Islamic conquest. And the jurists explain that when dhimmis go into the public baths, they have to wear either a mark around their neck or bells around on their ankles to show that they were not Muslims. Now, this is based on a principle of Muhammad. Muhammad said, "I've been sent with a sword in my hand to command people to worship Allah and associate no partners with him. I command you to belittle and subjugate those who disobey me, for those who look alike are of the same." That is, non-Muslims are not allowed to look like Muslims. They must be immediately, instantaneously recognisable as not being Muslims. This was all understood as an expression of being made small, as it says in Surah 9:29, fight against the people of the book until they pay the jizya and are tiny. Though these twin expectations of gratitude and inferiority are increasingly shaping contemporary geopolitics, that's a whole chapter of the book that I develop at some length. Many examples from statements made by Tony Blair and President Bush. President Obama gave a speech where he spoke about civilization's debt to Islam. Now, you could dispute the particular reasons he gives for that, but what's most notable about it, the reasons he thought were, was the idea he felt necessary to say that the non-Muslim world owes a debt to Islam. Because, in fact, non-Muslims do owe a debt to Islam. They owe their lives, their heads, and they have to pay for it every year. And you see, that theological grid that applies to the conquered peoples is being extended now, and it's being accepted by the leaders of the free world as one of the fundamental principles in relating to Islam, that you owe a debt to your conquerors. This is affecting our history textbooks. The fact is, the Islamic world conquered Greek centres of civilization and wiped them out in a number of areas. There's no more great Greek library in Alexandria or many parts. Where are the Greeks of Turkey? If you meet Greeks in Australia, ask them where their families come from. Often it's from Turkey, it's not from Greece. But our children are taught in school that it was Islam that rescued Greek learning and preserved it through the Dark Ages and then handed it over to Europe. This is kind of rescue by conquest. It's a very, very strange idea, but it's become acceptable. It's become part of our normal worldview that we're teaching us. We're schooling ourselves in, schooling our children in. In fact, I think you could make a very good case that the Dark Ages were caused by cutting off the Mediterranean and shutting off Western Europe from the source of life and wealth and prosperity, which was the Mediterranean itself and the connections through to the East. Anyway, these twin expectations of gratitude and inferiority are shaping political worldviews, discussions in the public domain. The key to all this is the Dhimma Pact itself. That is the underlying kind of controlling ideological cause of these arrangements. I want to use an example that I've used in other contexts that's explained in detail in the book, and speak about an Iranian guy called David Khalili, who's a Jew. And he organised an art exhibition in Sydney of Islamic art. He's incredibly wealthy and has a wonderful collection of Islamic art, and he devotes his life to presenting this collection and his art treasures around the world. He's spent millions and millions of dollars on this. And he's been honoured as well. He's been given honorary degrees by different universities. And it's really amazing because the Persian treatment of the Jews, was particularly bad. Because in Shiite Islam, there's the notion of cleanliness, which is another overlay over the whole Dhimma system. But what really interested me about David Khalili were his statements when he was interviewed on the ABC. He was asked whether his work to present Islamic art might help Muslims to understand that Jews are not inferior. And he responded, "I don't think there is a question of Jews being inferior. I don't think that thought has ever crossed any Muslim's mind." He's a highly educated, very experienced person with great wealth and sophistication who's lived in an Islamic country and is saying this. He went on to say, "Virtually one-third of the Quran, Surat al-Baqarah, is in praise of the two other religions, Judaism and Christianity. I don't think that's a question at all." You can't even ask the question. In fact, the question doesn't even exist. "I think the problem is ignorance," he said, "amongst people. And I can say on your program that I believe the real weapon of mass destruction is ignorance. If people try to understand their culture, their religion, their way of life, they started to respect each other." Now, one of the things that really struck me about these statements, is that they were utterly and completely false. And yet he's arguing that ignorance is the problem. For example, chapter 2 al-Baqarah is 7% of the Quran, not a third. Well, that's probably of no theological significance or ideological significance. But far from being in praise of Christians and Jews, it largely consists of a long litany of retorts given to the Jews of Medina as a kind of prologue to Muhammad's expulsion of them from the city and genocide of the final remaining tribe, the Bani Quraiza. Indeed, in Surah 2 is a verse that says Allah changed Jews into apes, another that says that the Jews forged their scriptures. I refer to the idea of the books being corrupted. And there are many anti-Jewish libels in the chapter. There is one verse that I found that speaks positively of Jews in that longest chapter in the Quran. Now, an event like this, it really makes you pause. Why would a capable, powerful, sophisticated person with plenty of experience on the ground be so deceived about their own identity? About the truth. Why would they be devoting their millions to promoting this lie around the world? And how could people who know nothing about what they're speaking about ever be able to critique such a testimony? How would you respond to that? I've collected many examples of this, and I refer to numbers of them in the book. I want to draw an analogy. In my pastoral ministry, I've often had to care for or support women who experienced abuse. Now, the battered woman praises her abusive partner and despises all the cruelty that she experiences. The idea that victims praise their oppressors, of course, is hardly a new one. No one can live without hope. An abused person will characteristically shift blame to other parties, even to themselves. That's much easier, in the effort to make life bearable and not completely hopeless. Survivors of abuse must blame themselves, because it gives them hope and a belief they've somehow got some control over the situation. If only I can find in myself the reason why they hate me, then I have some hope because I can avoid their wrath. They defend and identify with their abuser even as the abuse continues. I have seen the shock on the face of an abused person. When does this shock come, this terror that comes over them? They honestly believe that their husband's aggression is everyone else's fault, including their own. The terror and the shock comes at the point when they realise that the abuser is the problem. And nothing they or anyone else has done can justify that behaviour. This is the point of sheer terror. It's the point of realisation which victims are schooled to avoid. The denial, the gratitude, the expressions of inferiority help protect the victim from this devastating point of realisation. I recently read a statement produced by Christian leaders, bishops and others, patriarchs in the Middle East, protesting against Israel's occupation, looking forward to living in a multi-religious secular state encompassing what is now Israel and Palestine united together. I found it a very sad document. These are a captive people, testifying to their own abuse, yet denying it, schooled by a century of genocides and increasing rising Islamist violence and aggression to the point where they are imprisoned and unable to give an accurate and truthful testimony. Yet their testimony is listened to by Christians in the West. There's a very telling example of Archbishop Tutu was in Israel in the 90s and speaking in the Palestinian territory, speaking about against Israel. But what was really amazing about this speech that he was giving in a church was that up on the wall while he was speaking was a banner that said, "Saturday comes before Sunday." "We will kill the Jews first and then the Christians." He was speaking while this was being displayed. It was an amazing, amazing story. And the denial is very deep. I read such documents as this document from the Christian leaders in the Middle East, and I feel sad. It should move you to tears. Have compassion on these people and the situation they find themselves in. The third choice is also concerned with the wounds to the souls of non-Muslims. And indeed, I'm very concerned about the damage this does to Muslims as well, caused by centuries of abuse licensed by divine law. I devote a whole chapter to analysing the persecution of non-Muslims, particularly Christians today in Muslim nations, and I argue that in every single particular, the disadvantage that non-Muslims experience in Muslim countries track the stipulations of Islamic sacred law of Sharia to do with the Dhimma. There is a very deep resistance in Western cultures today to take theology, religious ideology, seriously. By and large, we've forgotten how to apply theological constructs to everyday life. There's also a great fear of being intolerant. I listened to an audio recording of Lee Bakker, who's the head of the police in Los Angeles, responsible for 12 million people in the community. And he made this statement. He said, "There is not a single piece of the conversation about the religion that is relevant in any respect whatsoever." He was absolutely determined to deny that faith had anything to do with his very challenging task of maintaining safety from terrorism in Los Angeles. It's an amazing level of denial, profound, profound denial, so extreme that you really need to ask, what is happening? Why is someone in that intense denial when the evidence is so contrary to it? Now, the West can no longer afford to lull itself to sleep by continuing to assert that all religions are the same, that all gods are the same, that religion doesn't matter. Theological illiteracy is not a solution to the problems caused by religious intolerance and hatred. We need the ability to think critically about faith, to understand and analyse its distinctive contributions with compassion, but also with truth. For this reason, one of the things I do in the third choice is to make a case that faith matters and to explain that it needs to be understood and interacted with on its own terms, on its own theological grids, if we are to understand the world today. Personally, this has been an incredibly hard book for me to write. It speaks of the most painful and difficult, deeply affecting themes of personal identity and spiritual history, as well as about geopolitics and the future destiny of nations. Professor Rafael Israeli read it, and he wrote to me that he himself was deeply moved to read the many references to Morocco and to the history of the Jews in Morocco, his own ancestral background. Now, I want to make a plea to you all. Please don't be like many who, when they're faced with the kinds of information that I discuss in this book, refuse to engage with it solely on the grounds that they can't imagine what the solution will be. I've seen that look in so many people's eyes when I lead them to a certain point to try and understand things. Then they look at me and they say, it's hopeless in that case. It's not hopeless. But the first step in finding a way through is acknowledging the truth. Living in denial is hopeless. Not facing up to things is hopeless. This is a terrible disease in the West, a kind of moral and spiritual laziness that refuses information we cannot solve. We have to know the solution before you will tell us the problem. This is a serious problem. It can't be dealt with as trivially as that. Our first challenge is to sit with the problem, understand it, absorb it, get to know it properly. I believe that if we do that while retaining human compassion and respect for the dignity of all people, Muslims and non-Muslims, solution will come. We will know, solutions will come. We will know when to draw the line, when to make the distinctions we need to make. A little quote from the author of the foreword to the book, Batayor. She says, "Today, whoever does not have a clear understanding of the complexities of the word thermitude can be considered an illiterate in matters of modern international policy and blind to present and future realities." Well, this book has been written as a weapon to destroy that illiteracy. I do commend the book to you. It was written to challenge and inform. I hope that no one will be the same after reading the book, or that you'll think the same about world events after reading it. It provides resources for linking up events and ideas of great importance in the world around us. As one person wrote to me recently, he said, "It's helped me join all the dots, including the dots I didn't know were there." It offers resources to engage with, understand, and respond to one of the greatest political and spiritual issues of our day. Thank you for this opportunity.